So, thanks. Thanks for being here. You're a thankful people. I guess you're the one remaining you, and you are the ones remaining to thank. So, I'll just kind of launch into things, and I guess I can say that I'm making films, installations, performances, curatorial projects for maybe 2 decades now, which feels, at some point that was seeing like a short period of time, right now it feels like a little while. And I work in a lot of different formats. I've made 3 features, like 30 short films, installations, and then today. And because I sort of come from a performance theory background as well, I try to think about, in Austin I was a professor for 8 years, I try to think about these artist talks, not so much as artist talks, but as ways of discussing things that might be a little more open. So equal parts screening, conversation, display, I guess. So that's the template that went out here. And yeah, I guess in some way this talk is intended to be like an audiovisual compass that is used as a way to describe my practice. So, and hopefully it will help us, help you guys who are interested to see this work tomorrow, which is the most recent-ish film that I made. It's a feature-length film that was shot in both Suriname and Serbia. It's perhaps the straightest, most like a documentary thing that I've made. And one of the really compelling aspects about it, about all the work, is that work, if it's big or if it's small, within a cinema space. So cinema is sort of the thing that I'm interested in. It's the space that I'm interested in, that I want to show this work, that I want people to experience it. And tomorrow you'll see and hear that the space that you're in is a really critical part of the experience of the image. So, but today's talk is called Psychedelic Ethnography, which is, has taken a few different forms. You can leave that light a little bit up. Okay. So it's taken a few different forms over the years, and now I sort of understand it less as an endpoint, but more as a methodology, like a way to approach a practice. And as all methodologies, it's important to have rules and then to break them, important to sort of shift the way that you understand things. So the compass, again, different compass, somehow strange, so many directions on it, is here referring to the map which refers to exploration, which refers to the possibility of getting lost entirely. So this really productive, in my mind, really productive, generative process of getting lost, not just finding yourself, or maybe getting lost so you can find yourself, but these two poles of location and dislocation. So this talk will occur along the lines of the psychedelic and the ethnographic, as those two words propose, and in the course of it, I'll just sort of break them down into somewhat floppy binaries, and then find some way to join them together in a catchy phrase. And as this image proposes, these terms are they're not accurate, representative, but in fact somewhat misrepresentative. And the third thing that I'll tuck its way, sneak its nose in, is that an expression? Canadian expression, right? Sneak your nose. Los Angeles, it's always is the phenomenological, which is the study of consciousness, the object of experience, which in this case, talking about psychedelic ethnography, is ourselves. So it's trying to find a way to think about ourselves as subjects, as objects, as things that we feel, things that we sense, not just things outside of us, but things within us that we happen to be. And we can look at the Aurora Borealis, which isn't a radical thing in of itself, right? It's only radical in relation to us. We're there to experience it, so it gains weight, it gains significance, it radiates. But it's always happening. It's happening right now, perhaps, someplace.
there is like him, but without us, it's nothing. It's just like a means that tree falls in the woods, perhaps, but it's actually where Borealis happens in the sky. So all of this is the way of talking about subject, and as this proposes, there are at least four subjects. And since I make films and don't give talks, I can make a lot more. I've probably given more talks than I've made films, but the films have taken more time to make. So let's say that I make films more than I make talks, and it's a little easier to show things than to talk about things or to let the talk be an illustration. So we'll start with the motion picture, which is will be this movie. It's 10 minutes long, shot in super 16mm film. I should say that this talk and this image has a little bit of strobe in it, so if you're sensitive to such things, you might just be aware of it. And if you're insensitive to such things, then you may not enjoy it. But let's try it. Yeah, it's so beautiful, but So I'm not going to talk about this right now, but I'll talk about it through the course of the talk. It's just it's always useful to like the audience, so they are sort of, if they're not involved, sort of become less aggressive, appreciation of whatever it is I'm doing. Maybe not. So anyway, back to the compass, right? So the audiovisual compass, which has changed again somehow, it's strange that it keeps shifting. So in order to talk about this psychedelic, this idea of the psychedelic and ethnographic, we have to talk, we should define our terms. So we begin with the psychedelic, which comes technically, the term for the word precisely means soul manifesting. It's from ancient Greek. It was coined in 1957 by Humphrey Osmond. And for me, the way that I think about the psychedelic is not necessarily through drug use, but just that what psychedelia affords is the understanding of the self through a subjective experience of the world. So we can think about psychedelia, and it's, I think within the West we tend to talk about it in terms of LSD, which is what this woman was taking in the film, or mushrooms, psilocybin comes from indigenous communities in all throughout, actually. My friend grew up in Newfoundland, so they used to get deep into it when she was like 6 or 7 or something like that. But the psychedelic, in a really broad sort of functional way, is a definition for the understanding who we are through this subjective, purely subjective inward experience of the world. And there are a few poles, going back to thinking about the compass, this ways that we can think about this, ways that we can frame it. And we would say maybe in the east, northeast, southeast, I'm not sure which one, we have drugs, right? So we have Ruth, who has taken a hit of LSD 2 hours before being in this film, and she's looking into the, through a mirror, she's looking through the lens of a camera, she's staring at herself, and we are witnessing the experience of somebody who's looking at their own image. We're in a place of kind of thinking that she's looking at us, but it's clear that she's actually looking past us, because she's looking past the mirror, past the screen, past this beam of light which we're in right now, and into some other thing entirely. So she becomes a conduit, a vehicle to get this. And this isn't something that I have invented, certainly. It's something that our friend Terry Gilliam used, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which, if you haven't seen it, is a really wonderful film, because it's a very terrible experience watching it, which is not something, when people talk about the ecstatic of drug use, they don't usually talk about the awful, horrible, confusing, traumatic. There's a text by Henri Michaux, which opens up this film I'll share tomorrow, called Miserable Miracle, which is more or less what the psychedelic is. It's this terror of having a body. And this film, in many ways, is boring, confusing, aggressive, nauseating, which is quite similar to what the drug experience can be. So as a simulacra of an experience, it's quite on point. We have a film like Enter the Void, Gaspar Noé, which, if you haven't seen, I would recommend watching the first 10 minutes and then turning it off and doing something else. Basically, the protagonist does some DMT, which is a derivative taken from ayahuasca, which we all know comes from sort of the Amazon, and it's known as like the death trip. So you move out of your body and you go into the afterlife, but then what happens if you're shot while you're out of your body? And you're just a spirit floating forever until, spoiler alert,
your spirit enters somebody else's body, you have sex with your sister, and then give birth to yourself. So you don't have to see it, but it's a trope, right? It's a device. So this is one pole. The other pole, you said drugs were in the east part of parties. We could say that maybe on the other side is the west, or dreams. So this is another way of thinking about this psychedelic. Now, the surrealists were really excited about dreams because they were excited about dreams, and then they were excited about cinema, because cinema seemed to offer up a space that ran parallel to dreams. Only in the dream can you have cause and effect broken. Can you jump from geography to geography? Can temporality become, things can move backwards, things can move forwards? And as we all know, telling somebody about a dream is one of the most tedious experiences for a listener that you can have, right? Like last night, I had this incredible dream. I was in a forest, and I was walking through the forest, and I saw my dad. I hadn't seen my dad in a little while, and he was like, "What are you doing here, son?" I was like, "Well, it's nice to see you, Dad." He's like, "Take this rock." And he gave me a rock, and I looked at it. It was in the shape of a triangle, and it had to look like a fossil. Maybe it was a fossil snake. And then I brought it up. Right? It's really boring. Then me telling you this, but I'm excited because I'm reimagining my subjective experience. But the subjective experience is hard to transmit to your external selves, yourself that are outside of me. Boonwell, this film is one of the formative films for me. It's one of the things that made me realize the sort of possibilities of cinema to produce a simultaneously closed but infinite system. A space that made sense while we were in it, like the dream, but then stopped making sense while we were out of it. And Boonwell said that the film seems to be the involuntary imitation of the dream, which is a really beautiful way of thinking about cinema. And so we have another film by Germaine Dulac from 1928. This is the same time period that these guys are cutting up eyeballs, as the pixies said, and breaking mirrors, walking backwards, walking through space. Also, I have a film which, let's see how it goes. Maybe I'll come to you, maybe not. But a film that I made in 2014 called Greetings from the Ancestors, where I dipped into a Xhosa South African dream healing community, healers and called Sangomas, who believe that the dream is not the echo of the lived experience, as those of us who go into psychoanalysis or Freudian Jungian analysis believe, but rather it's predictive of the lived experience. So that if you have a dream, then somebody that you tell your dream to a Sangoma healer, and they say, "Oh, well, we should go do that. We should find that person. We should go into the forest and find the petrified snake and that your father gave you, and then we'll see what happens, because your dream is kind of..." They also said that it's evidence of ancestors. This is how we know that we've ancestors, because ancestors communicate with us through our dreams and propose a future for us. So we have east-west, let's say southwest. We have trance, another pole of the psychedelic. Now, trance is also maybe the bridge between the psychedelic and the ethnographic, because in a lot of anthropology, ethnography, which is the study of, can't talk about it yet. So we have the trance ceremony, right? It's a long-standing subject within the documentary field. Here we have healing on of hands, Pentecostal Christians. I think the top right one is from a Christian ska concert, where many Christians play music. Here we have the trance from a noise band in Providence, Rhode Island called Mind Flayer. You guys know Mind Flayer, you love Mind Flayer. And some more just rock and roll freaking out, which has its parallel in Indonesian flagellation rituals, Turkish whirling dervishes, Surinese, those are the Wisi ceremony from the Matawai, or the Yanomano Indians in northern Amazon, who blow hallucinogenic snuff into each other's noses and then experience the divine, the spiritual, the magical, the other, the outside. So the trance has a thing that exists both in, where did I say, the southwest? Maybe it's southeast, because here we have the west and here we have the east, but maybe the south and the north, that's what I said. So for me, all this stuff kind of happened because I was going to a lot of noise concerts, a lot of experimental music concerts, and was really excited about what was happening to my body being in these spaces, you all are sitting here right now, which is a similar position to how we experience cinema. Most of you are not shaking around, being vibrated, acted upon. It's a thing that happens in music, and then in this concert, you would feel yourself as a body, as a collective, as a thing that was part of a bunch of other things. And I began to think about whether or not, or how I could get cinema to do that as well. So thinking about, what was it, drugs, dreams, and trance. And then maybe we should, why don't we just do it? Let's do it. So this is, this film's a little bit long. I'm going to do all right, 30 minutes, 26 minutes. We'll watch the first third half of it. So it actually begins in a community in Swaziland where effectively like key Swahili Pentecostal Christians. So it's a syncretic Christian culture they practice, which was founded by a priest who, when he was put in jail for traveling through South Africa during apartheid for not having identification as a black man, was put into jail. He was visited by angels who didn't understand the angels, but the angels said to him, you need to go back to Swaziland to help your people. And he was like, I don't believe in this stuff. Who are you guys? And then he woke up. And then a little while later, they came back, and they're like, really, you need to go back, we'll help you out. And he's like, well, I gotta work. And then they said, no, you need to work, go back and help your people. And he's like, yeah, but who are you? And he woke up, and then it happened one more time. He's like, okay. He's like, okay, I'll go back. You'll help me farm, we'll help these things work out. So he's somebody who started this particular community, which is the Church of Jericho, also. Another way to sort of understand this stuff contextually, historically, is that Swaziland, which is just renamed to East Swahili, I think, is a monarchy run by a king who has, I think, upwards of 50 wives, and it also has a 54% HIV infection rate. So it's not, people are not, these guys are not in the best of conditions, their representation is not so wonderful. So what's happening has another function. We can talk about these things, trance, drugs, dreams, in a really like subjective, visceral way, or we can talk about it in a sort of functional, like how do we continue to live, sort of way. Let's watch. So I'm not really talking about the films themselves, but just talking about using them as background material or support material for this talk. But I can say that I went to this place initially I went there because I'd heard about these Sangoma who took a drug, which was the bark of a tree. I heard about dream healers who took a drug, which was the bark from a tree, to increase the strength of their dreams. And it felt like if you double up the possibilities of representing a thing, right? Dreams, you can't film because you can't get inside people. And drugs, the subjective experience, you can't film because you can't get inside them. And then maybe some other thing would come out. And as is maybe evidenced by these two works, there's a bit more left in this one. All my work is on Vimeo, so if you want to see it, you can see it. Part of what you're perhaps catching on to is that in my work, I'm trying to use cinema as a vehicle, not just to have a thing happen here, but to have a thing happen here. So let's talk more about that. We could say that with all of this, the subject is perception. So we talk about the subject, but in the dreams, and with drugs, with trance, in all places, the subject of the dream is perception. The subject of the drug experience is perception. The subject of the trance experience is perception. How you perceive the world, how you arrive at the world. And when we look at this, we realize that this is a still image. There's no movement in this image. None. None at all. And you see movement. If you raise your hand if you see movement, because it's possible that you don't. Some vibration, move your head to that side. If you see movement, it's only happening inside of you. And it's happening because you are
there's something wrong with your brain. And there's something wrong with all of our brains. And the subject is perception is contingent upon where we are. Right? So the experience of the world, first and foremost, in this idea of the psychedelic has to do with us, how we perceive, how we see, how we are, how we understand ourselves. And I refer to this a clip from this really beautiful film by Toshio Matsumoto called Funeral Parade of Roses, which I would recommend all of you see. I would say see it right now, but maybe you can wait until afterwards. But it's in every sense, Toshio Matsumoto was an experimental filmmaker. Also, he made commercials. He also made feature films. And this particular film is, in many ways, the answer to it's like the non-heteronormative, politically engaged, queer Greek mythology answer to the French New Wave, made around the same time. And so it's based around the Oedipus myth. And it's a really like exciting film. There's one sequence in this that I always was very enthusiastic about. It's in a way what led me to make Trips number 7. So we'll just look at that. So the first guy I'm really excited about because he's saying that he is floating above the chair, but the image obviously is not floating above the chair. We can see that there's a real gap between what he's experiencing, how he feels, how his inner self is, and what he's able to articulate to us. And this is the fundamental problematic of the psychedelic, is that one's experience, but the communication of it never kind of hits. So we can talk about like the Aurora Borealis, out in Los Angeles, reason number 1 to live there, reason number 2 to live there, reason number 3 to live there. I don't know if there are any more reasons. The way this is in Tahiti, not that's still a good reason. But you know, all this stuff is happening all the time, with or without us. And that wow that I have, this upside down image, is thrilling because I'm there to see it. So, the subject, me, is the subject with perception, is me. So this brings us to the second part, which is the ethnographic. And I'll give you, I'm an artist, I'm not an anthropologist, and I don't, which doesn't mean I get to be a lazy anthropologist or get to like not be beholden to the sort of ethical terms of anthropology, but it does mean that I'm not after the things that anthropologists after. So let me give you this definition, which is my own non-academic definition, one that I use to better understand myself. And it is the understanding of the self through an objective record of someone that is not the self. So ethnography is the study of visual culture specifically, so it's looking at how other people are so as to understand me. I can record them, I can film them, I can document them, I can see what they're doing. That helps me figure out who they are, and then I understand who I am, because I'm understanding myself relationally. This idea finds its definition broadly in the actuality, this term, the actuality, which happens at the advent of cinema. And you can see it's an example here, the Workers League in the Battery, the first film made by the Lumiere brothers. We could see it in this remake that I made, one of many remakes that people have made of this film. Mine was Workers League in the Factory Dubai, which I made in 2008. All of those buildings were being made simultaneously, as if the factory had expanded to be an architectural state. And there were, I think, 20,000 workers who were rotating at the shift. And they were all color-coded, and I was really thinking about like how this production changed from one space to the next. And the proposition was that by looking at this stuff, we can understand it, we can know, we can get information. Right. So we have within the frame, again, the poles of the ethnographic. When we say the actuality was northeast, right? That's what we said, it's northeast, let's say it is. So the recording or the record could maybe be the north of northwest. And if you've seen this film, Robert Flaherty, 1922, great, incredible documentary depiction of what life is like in the Arctic. Fantastic. So spot on, so precise, so like objective, right? We see how our friend Nana, 1923, before we could record sound,
before cameras were very heavy, so they couldn't move. There's no movement of cameras. We had to set everything up on a tripod. The film was really slow, so we had to hand crank it sometimes. It was a very slow process, but we took this stuff, went up to the Arctic, the actual Arctic, and filmed what life is like there. It's great. Totally worth it. Or something like Chantal Ackerman's Dest, which is a beautiful film, a series of 10-minute long shots mapping out the movement from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, using every shot. Over the course of 2.5 hours, you see how visual culture changes, how bodies change by what they're wearing, how the fur hats get way to baseball caps. It's in a moment when the Soviet Union is undergoing some serious rotations. So that's that. So we've got the record recording, and then we've got the document, which is sort of very important, very critical within the space of ethnography of nonfiction, is to think about the document, the testimony. And we had instances of this, like Holy Ghost People by Peter Adair, Steve Reich did the soundtrack for this, and it's, I think, Terry Riley, and it's a portrait of Pentecostal snake handlers. So we go back to the trans thing. There's this film by Bruce Conner, Crossroads, 1976, Art of My Birth, not in celebration of it, I think, which is a terrifying document. It's a collection of documents of the Bikini Atoll tests, in, which at the time, in the 40s, was the most filmed event in the world. So you can sort of see it, but all of these things are dummy destroyers that have film cameras on them running. There are airplanes hovering around, they're filming this. And so this film, Crossroads, it's 30 minutes, and you just see a nuclear explosion over and 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 over again. And at some point, the document becomes emptied out of its terror. I mean, that's my hope that none of us have ever seen the nuclear explosion, but we've seen it on film. And this film presents another way of experiencing it, getting to the point where the thing represented shifts. But still, at its heart, it's a document. You receive the footage through the Freedom of Information Act and made it into this film. The second half of it has a soundtrack by Terry Riley. The first half is done by Patrick Gleason. And it's a really haunting film if you ever get to see it, but that's big and not small. Or a film like Chick Strand's Fake Fruit Factory, which ostensibly is a document of the women who are working in a fruit factory. And most of the information we get is going through voice recordings, which are translated. So here the workers are talking about the boss, who they say has a funny little sausage. So in all of these instances, again, we can get to the point and say that the subject in all of these, again, is perception. It's how we perceive the object, how we perceive the world. And if you know these works, you know that I'm being a little bit disingenuous in how I'm representing them. But there's another thing that's happening. To get to that, I can look at Trentine and Haas' work, important postcolonial theorists, who in 1983 said, there is no such thing as documentary, whether the term designates a category of material, a genre, an approach, or a set of techniques. Now, what she means by that is that when you're filming, to frame a shot is to not frame a shot. So this image of this woman, what is outside the image of this woman? What is not being selected? To record is to not record. That these processes, these objective processes of documentation, are still contingent upon the subjectivity of the author, these decision-making processes. So the representation of the world is a selective representation. We all know this. It's not new. There's no revelation that's happening right here. This is just talking about how these two things operate. And of course, Trentine and Haas doesn't propose that images are untrue, that they don't matter, because obviously they do. But she's just saying that context matters, and that the context is actually us as well. That we're significant parts of the construction of meaning in relationship to the image. So, again, the moving image that is not moving, that moves when we're here looking at it. When we're not here, it's not moving. Also, when we're here, it's not moving. In this sort of tangled web that I'm skillfully weaving, I can say that what I understand from all these things of this wedding, these two sort of difficult pieces, the the psychedelic that tries to discuss its subjective experience and sometimes fails in the transmission, or the objective, the ethnographic, the objective experience of the world that also somehow falters when trying to do that, is that one way to understand this stuff is to recognize that form and content are not the same thing, that you can't have one without the other. And just to explain this, we can look at this early, this is cinema in some sense. I said it was the Lumiere film. This is actually when cinema happens, when on a judgment's bed, two guys want to figure out if a horse is ever off the ground. So, prior to this moment, we did not know. Prior to 1878, we did not know if there was a moment while a horse was running, if at some point all four of its feet were off the ground. We can see in image 2 and 3 that yes, indeed, it's true. And we can see this because we have a camera that can shoot in succession. And so the image, the form of the image, is in fact what the image is. It's what tells us, it's how we understand what this thing is. Muybridge is interesting because we have his locoanimal locomotion studies, which is a really amazing, this is just a small aside, there's a really amazing text about Muybridge written by Hollis Frampton, who is an avant-garde American filmmaker, called Fragments of a Tesseract. Because Muybridge was a photographer, he did this thing, and he was a photographer in the Crimean War, and then he spent the rest of his life making these animal locomotion studies. And it's not because he was really into like muscular men, or large men, or large women, or small women, or horses, or whatever, but like nonstop for the rest of his life, these were the images that he made. And Hollis Frampton proposes this really beautiful way of thinking about cinema, thinking about these poles of, I don't know, maybe the psychedelic, that while Frampton was in the Crimean War, his wife had an affair with a man. Muybridge came back, found out this had happened, rented a stagecoach, drove for 24 hours, arrived at his wife's mother's house, and shot him in the head, and then drove back. Was put in jail, his hair turned white, for the week that he was in jail, and then he was freed on justifiable homicide, as one would be, of course. So I'm being facetious, but the proposition that Frampton says is that this moment, this like specific moment of time in which Muybridge, in a crime of passion, holds a gun to his wife's lover's head and pulls the trigger, then spends the rest of his life trying to figure out what happens in that moment, the moment between decision and action, between life and death, and that this is a way of getting closer and closer and closer to this thing, to use the photographic image as evidence. But of course it never arrives, because the objective record is not the subjective record. So, going back to this, my understanding of nonfiction fiction is that there is construction in all things. So we can go back and talk about to illustrate this idea of nonfiction equals fiction, this was shot 3 times. Lumiere brothers' parents owned the factory. So, they're like, ladies, you guys need to leave, right? My sons want to film you. They're making a film. Okay, so you guys are working for me, you're under my employ, you need to leave. Oh, it didn't work. So everybody needs to come back, we need to do it again. We do it again. Everybody needs to come back, we didn't quite get it, we need to do it again. 3 times this was filmed. So the proposition that the document of the thing, I mean, it still is a representation of workers leaving the film factory. It still is a non-fictional moment, but it's also a fictional moment. Also, the same as our boy, Robert Flaherty, who, if any of you have ever tried to make a film in an igloo without lights, know how hard it is to film inside. Especially in 1922, when your film stock is really slow and you need lots of lights and there's no electricity, so you can't really bring the electricity into the Arctic. So how do you film inside the igloo? You make a half igloo. You treat the igloo like a movie set, and you have the people inside of it performing what they would do. But let's say that you got there and realized that that your friend Namek was no longer using the spear that he was hunting with the gun. But you're there to make a film about the Inuit. So
but you notice his father's spear hanging on the wall of his igloo, and you say, "Man, would you mind hunting with your father's spear?" And so suddenly the document becomes a reenactment. But when it's presented, and it's not that it's not true, it's still Nanook doing it, it's still in the Arctic, it still has aspects of actuality, but definitely there's fiction and nonfiction. And for me, that's a really important way to think about the construction of the world. We can even look at Jean Bruch's Le Maître Fou, which is a trance film shot with the Hauke, and there's a lot of foaming dog blood. It's a pretty intense film, a critique of colonialism. It was criticized for being barbaric and exploitative, but in fact, the Hauke commissioned Jean Bruch to make a film about their ritual, which was a critique of colonialism. So, fiction, nonfiction, where we align ourselves, or this film by Ben Russell, which is going to be shown tomorrow, called Good Luck, which has a subject staring back at us for a minute, a number of subjects, not spoiler alert, but you see it, it happens. And this subject is staring into the camera. We understand as we're watching it that even though we see his arm stopping and starting it, that because it's within the vessel of a film, that it's been built. Something has happened, some sort of construction. I've asked the guy, I've put the camera there, I've lit him. Some other thing has happened around it. So for me, all of these are really exciting ways to think about filmmaking, to think about representation, to think about this. They're not problems at all. They're not limits, they're expansions. And this is something that I've always understood to be true. And which means that I'm excited about this woman, who we don't get to see so often anymore, Kellyanne Conway. Right there she is again. Representation equals misrepresentation, this idea of fake truth, which as if it's a new idea. As if we've always, in the US we talk about People's History of the United States, the Howard Zinn book, which proposes that the narrative of history is different to tell it from the suppressed, from the working class, from a minority. That if you tell it from the story of power, you get one kind of history, you get another. So yes, fake news always, fake history always. It doesn't mean there's not truth in there. It doesn't mean all of these things are fake, but it does mean that there is representation happening. Again, we can talk about faces, we can talk about Ruth, and this setup in Badlands, where the camera is at an angle on the side of a very precarious cliff for two sides, and she's staring through a mirror at herself. So she appears to be looking at herself, we realize then that she's looking into a mirror, and then she disappears as if it's a magic trick. Which is not so different than this wonderful image. Then speech. So we can think about this, right? My two frame is to not frame is different than his two frame is to not frame. Probably this image doesn't have other photographers in the background, it doesn't have these multiple frames, it just has her. Right? And so wherever you position yourself determines how the image operates. So we get to psychedelic ethnography. And for me, as I said, like the practice of filmmaking, practice of art making, is about trying to wed together two things that seem fundamentally at odds with each other. But there's such pleasure to be had in both of them that I don't want to just resign myself to one side or the other. I'm excited about the subjective experience. I'm also excited about the fact that what cinema does is that we get to stare at people as if and have them stare back as if they're there with us, when actually they're with us in some other time, but they're transported in. So it indulges both of these things. And we can say that the fourth or fifth pole of psychedelic ethnography is pleasure. So I can try to forget, I'm not sure if it'll work. Yes, maybe I'm just thinking slower. So for me, this like optical, this flicker is also really exciting as a kind of optical exercise. If you go fast enough, you begin to see a third, it's not just black or white, a third color, which doesn't exist, but exists inside your retina. And it depends sort of on how much screen time you've had during the day. If you've had a lot, then your browsing comes, get burned out of it, and you don't really see that much.
crash again. It's really dangerous. For me, the crux of it, of this process, of this methodology of trying to get close to join, capture both the subjective experience and the objective experience, and allowing the failures and successes of both, is this thing, this idea of knowledge versus understanding. That knowledge is a Western paradigm that owns subjects, and understanding is a process of empathizing. So psychedelic ethnography proposes that we hedge our bets on the side of understanding, that we don't try to name things, we don't try to point to them, but we allow them to happen temporally, that we move with them, and we let the sound and the temporality and all of these other things that we've seen briefly in those two other works of mine activate the audience, so that the subject is perception, so that we're aware how these things are happening. Moving through a few of these films, Tura Hitzi, Jean Rich, another really is a film where he proposes, in fact, that he is the person who makes, if they're waiting for a trance ceremony to begin, it's not happening, and then he decides, okay, the sun is setting, I'm not going to be able to film, I'm going to take my camera and walk into this village and start filming. And as soon as he walks in and starts filming, the spirits enter the world. And he thinks about himself as a device, a thing that initiates a certain kind of trance, calls it semi-trance, which is a way of thinking that the presence of the author is always present. If you're making a film, if you're interfering, if you're there in the world, you're interfering, acting upon, acting with the world, and that you have to allow yourself to be present in this capacity. There's a woman named Catherine Russell, who isn't related to me, who talks about this idea of surrealist ethnography, about what is generated when we begin to question the authority of a narrator, when we're moved into a space of having to ask if a thing is objective, if the thing is actual, who we are in relation, if this thing is constantly moving. She points to Buñuel's Land Without Bread, another film, hopefully you're remembering all of these titles. But in Land Without Bread, there's a man with a British accent who says, this woman is 28 years old. And you have to decide, as a viewer, do you believe the narrator or do you believe the image? And later on, the image proposes a whole other step of understandings. And so this position, the subject position, is really slippery. It's always moving between subjective and objective experience. This finds another enunciation through this idea of sensory ethnography, which people like Houston Castleman Taylor, Brandon Caravell, out of the Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab, are sort of working with how do you make a film about fishing that's not descriptive but is empathic? What does it feel like to be a fish on a boat? What does it feel like to be a seal? What does it feel like to be the wind? And these are all really more complicated ways of understanding how to approach a subject, or how do you approach all of these things, not just thinking about a human perspective or a way of speaking that this is that. So the subject is the subject, obviously, the author is the subject, that's me. So here are the three poles, finally. This is northwest, southeast, south, north. That the subject is perception, but the subject is the subject, the person on screen, the author is the subject, I am also activating whatever is happening, and then most importantly, in my mind, the audience is the subject. That your presence as an interpreter, as the cracked mirror, the reflection, the bad reflection of the thing, is important in the construction of meaning, what a thing is, what it does, how it does. But cinema, again, like that vibrating image, doesn't happen without us. The experience of cinema, and that was more or less the the experience of cinema is an experience of, it's a collective experience, it's an experience that involves all of us. It's the thing that's happening right now. Cinema isn't just this, it's actually this line, that projector that's behind you, these speakers that are in front of you, these sound waves that are moving through you. It's all of this stuff that's sort of organizing itself simultaneously. And for me, psychedelic ethnography is a way of activating the experience of cinema so that it activates us within it, so that we become participants in sort of the construction of a particular kind of experience. Lost my mind. Don't have any more. Just
just set list. I love this. Thank you for your patience. No. Okay. That's not gonna work. It doesn't want to see. Oh, wait, I have one more trick. Great. This is where the tricks are revealed. This is like the magician behind the trick. Was that? The experience is a collective experience in which we're conscious of ourselves, in which we're activated, moving with the thing, in which we become alive. So in this experience, cinema is a thing you can get inside of as another subject, and I was walking downtown and I started smelling weed everywhere. I saw like this gang of like 400 kids all smoking green hair with 50 or something. I was like, what is going on? That's crazy.
It sounds really exciting.
There it is. So, thanks. Thanks for your.